And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We are recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800. Our guest today is the former Undersecretary for Benefits for the Department of Veterans Affairs, Allison Hickey. Allison, say hello to the Veterans Radio listening audience.
Hello, and it's great to be talking with you all today.
Well, we're glad to have you, and my partner Dale Thronberry is in the council room with me. Dale, say hello to everybody.
I am. Good afternoon, General.
Hi, Dale. How are you doing?
I am terrific, and we're anxious to learn. We've already learned about your military background, and you know, just to review kind of for our audience, is that she's a graduate of the Air Force Academy, a pilot, which is always cool, and did a lot of great things with the Air Force. It was in for 27 years and retired in November of 2007, and she was then appointed or was offered this position, I'm guessing, as Undersecretary for Benefits of the Department of Veterans Affairs on 6/6/11, D-Day.
Yes.
For Allison.
And I'm claiming the victory forward.
There you go.
So, Allison, let's start with this. Our veterans who are listening to Veterans Radio may be very aware of what the Undersecretary for Benefits is involved in, but I suspect most people in the general public don't know what an undersecretary is and don't know what an Undersecretary for Benefits is at the VA. Maybe you can give us a little background.
Yes, so there are, in VA, there are three major areas that respond directly to the cabinet secretary and then to the president on all the issues of veterans. One of them is the health side. The person that leads all the medical side or health side is the undersecretary for health. Then there is the undersecretary for benefit who leads about eight different programs, many of which some of your readers may have leveraged, whether it's a disability claim, a pension, a going to school on the GI Bill, a VA home loan program, a voc rehab, an employment kind of program, an insurance, so all the service group life insurance for our military members, and then veteran group life insurance and others for our veterans after they separate or retire. And then finally, while I was there, I stood up the transition portion of VBA, or the Veterans Benefits Administration, as well. And then the last administration is Memorial Affairs, that handles all of the memorials, all the cemeteries that are that VA has responsibility for, and works in that space.
Well, and listeners, we're going to refer to the general with her permission as Allison during this podcast and interview.
Please do. I've actually asked everyone to do that even while I was in VA, so I appreciate your doing that.
Allison, give us some sense of how big this benefits portion of VA is in terms of either budget or people. Sort of, it's amazing to me how big it is, and I think a lot of folks don't understand that, and it later on leads to why there are some complexities.
Yes, so if there are 22 million veterans alive today, the Veterans Benefit Administration, between the veterans and the actual service members that they support as well in VA home loans or GI bills, because they do that as well for currently serving members, it's a 12 million population. A budget of when I left, the budget was $95 billion, of which all but $3 billion of that goes directly into the hands of veterans, their family members, and survivors. So it's not $95 billion for VA, it's $95 billion, or $2 billion for veterans, their families, and survivors. So basically it means there is enough staff in this world for 3 cents on the dollar it takes to distribute $92 billion to veterans every year. The size of the organization was about 21,000 employees, of which about 10,000 are doing what people are most familiar with, at least it seems, but those are disability compensation claims. And then another couple thousand are doing the education claims, the GI Bill claims. And then it spreads out over the other portfolios of benefits that are provided to veterans, including some 700 or 800 people answering phones every day for call-ins and things of that nature.
Well, and again, geographically, the division or department that you were responsible for covered the entire country. A lot of physical presence.
So we had 56 regional offices. The one in Michigan is obviously in Detroit, but they also touch other parts of the state. We also, though, have an overseas presence. VA has one. There's a large office in Manila that handles a lot of the veterans who are stationed over there and overseas, and they also now help take, you know, surge work from stations who may be a little swamped. There are also VBA employees in all kinds of countries that are there for separating service members. And there's an awful lot of veterans who live overseas. And so these people support, you know, the questions they might have, the filing concerns, the help they might need from those kind of forward deployed locations. There's also a footprint in Puerto Rico. And they serve the Virgin Islands and some of the other Caribbean areas as well.
When you first came to the job in June of 2011, what was the status of the benefits group that you were taking over, did you feel?
So first, I will tell you, as everybody probably well remembers, in 2011, they had just started responding to the new three presumptive conditions for our Vietnam veterans exposed to Agent Orange, and that put 260,000 new claims overnight in their inventory in October of 2010, just before I arrived. And so they were trying to work through those and sort through those and get staff trained on how to do them and get them stood up and try to move forward to start tackling those, which they were required by law to do first. And so by the time I got there, the backlog of claims, which are any claims older than 125 days, had grown to nearly 550,000 claims. They were doing them all by hand in paper with little rubber fingertips on their hands, looking at claims files that could be, you know, upwards of 2 feet tall, you know, not unlike, you know, looking at a little toddler. And memorizing 850 diagnostic codes in their heads. And it was just, when you looked at it, just not an efficient, not an effective process that a lot of really hardworking people were trying to do to their very best, and about 52% of them were veterans themselves, kind of frustrated with the tools they had on hand. And they were falling further and further and further behind. And they didn't like it, veterans didn't like it, and everybody deserved a better answer. There wasn't a technology system. There wasn't a way to file claims online. There weren't standard forms. There weren't rules-based calculators. There was no enabling capability in the technology realm. They weren't organized to do the work in lanes with the work segmented at all. So everything went through one filter. Whether you were the best employee, the, you know, longest, most mature employee, really knew the work, or whether you were brand new in the door, you had the equal opportunity to pull some of the hardest cases. And it just wasn't very well organized under the people, process, or technology realm, and that's what we set out to do, was to create an integrated plan, deliver that plan in 45 days, and execute it on the next 3 years to get that backlog down 90% from where it peaked in 2013 at 611,000 claims, and today it hovers between 70,000 and 80,000 claims, and some of those have very good reasons for not getting done in 125 days, which wouldn't help a veteran if they did them fast.
Well, one of the things that, as somebody who's been a practitioner in this area during that period of time, we've seen tremendous progress been made over those last 3 or 4 years. And it was, I think, surprising to everybody when they found that it was all paper. When I tell a veteran, it's all paper, you know, it'll take them so many days to get it from the mail room to the file room. How did you drive change in an organization that big which in 2011 did have the information technology systems and other things that you would have expected in a business or corporation of similar size.
So I had not only had that experience in the Air Force where I had to do fundamentally change, you know, a big portfolio, part of the Air Force portfolio where nobody really wanted to change, but we had to. We had a bias for action that said we had to. I then went over to industry for 3 years where I learned about some fundamental things that added to my understanding of how to make those kinds of large transformations and change management. And so when I arrived, you know, in VA, one, I had a mandate from the Senate SFAC chair to deliver a plan in 45 days. And so I, what we did was what I know that works, and it works in industry, which is we pulled all the key stakeholders together. People were a little surprised. We had not only VBA people, but we had field people and headquarters people, and we had VSOs, and we had lawyers, and we had union reps, and we had, you know, people with just industry people that had great ideas, and we just pulled them all together, locked ourselves in a room for 3 or 4 days, and went through, siphoned through an entire list of about 600 different good ideas that had been submitted through an innovation effort, and culled those down to about 45 of what we thought to be the most promising, and integrated them into whether or not they would be a people initiative, something that would change the way we're organized or trained to do the work, a process initiative, something that could be leaned up or re-engineered or had already started that process, improved some metal, and what technology would need to do to enable all of that. And we literally put that on paper, put all those initiatives into those categories, integrated it, and then I asked every one of the regional offices to identify a change management agent, a new position we stood up, who was a very well-respected, a little more junior in the organization, but employees could approach, VSOs could approach, anybody could approach, and they became part of the impetus to help us move through not just the structure of change, but the culture of change. And I think...
I think, General, there's a good example, again, of one of those pearls of wisdom you're giving us that I want to make sure our listeners focus on. It takes a culture of change. You can't just say, do it, and here's the process. You've got to change that whole culture of people buying in. And did, were there special steps or activities that you undertook to make sure folks throughout the 56 regional offices were buying into the cultural change?
Yeah, so one of the things that I believe that every senior leader needs to do, and I personally did this, is when you're going to do that kind of a large change, you've got to get in it up to your, I say, armpits. And mm-hmm. I really did that. So in the first week or two I was there, I asked for the all-employee email list, and there was a little nervousness about giving me that. Well, they might respond to you if you send something, and I commented, that's kind of the point. And so I started sending personal emails from me. Nobody wrote them for me. I wrote them. If they responded back, I responded. If it got to a veteran, which it typically did, I responded. And I just got involved in a very open communication strategy because I felt like if you don't let people voice their concerns to you and you don't listen and respond, then they don't keep talking to you, and you're going to walk off a cliff when you're trying to lead that large of a change. And
part of this was demonstrating that leadership cared and wanted to change.
Yes, and what I found too, I went out and immediately went to 12 different regional offices, and instead of going and letting, you know, a leadership person give me a briefing sitting in a room, you know, with, you know, nice chairs and everything, I said, nope, we're not doing that. You're going to walk me around through the regional office, and I'm going to start wherever the veteran stuff starts. So if it comes in the mail room, I want to have the full experience of that veteran's, you know, information and communication to us from the get-go, and then how that claim is handled at every step of the way, and I want you to make me a claim and take me through the process. I only had to do that about 3 different regional offices before it became really clear to me where things were broken. And you know who knew it all along were the actual employees. They just didn't have before sort of the focused effort. They didn't have the resources to make the change, and they just needed someone to say, okay, here we go, and be just absolutely dogged persistent on making that transformation happen and improving the way they could do the work, which they really wanted to change. They just needed someone to help get them there. And then all for the betterment of the veteran themselves. So when I arrived, veterans were waiting, as you well know, and many of your readership knows, more than 300 some odd days for their initial claim decision. And today it's down to something like, you know, 70 to 90 days they're waiting. In some cases it's really light depending on how many issues are in the claim, but, you know, substantial numbers of days taken off that wait.
So one of the things, General, you mentioned, I'm sorry, Allison, you mentioned were that you reached out to all the employees. Dale's reading, I think, one of the things you're referring to.
Where your average claim went down. I can't believe these numbers. My claim took almost a year and a half. We now complete 99% of the claims in less than 92 days is your average.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
So the way we did that was we increased the productivity of our employees by 81%. You know, when you give them a better way to organize around the effort, so we segmented all the work so the really fast claims could go down the express lane. No, not like, unlike when you go to the grocery store, if you only have one or two items, you don't want to wait behind the person who's got a cartload full.
Right.
And so we did that. We segmented the work according to lanes, which is what industry does, too. So we adopted an industry model. Then we also completely changed our training program. Our poor employees, in many cases, were showing up, basically sitting next to someone well-intentioned and learning how to do claims by looking over the shoulder. And you just can't do that. Military people know one of the best things about our military in this country is how well we train people to do this mission. Mm-hmm. We weren't doing that in VBA. We fundamentally overhauled the complete training program and now mandated a complete long training program before you ever even got involved in really touching veteran claims, and really got people up to speed faster with a much higher level of quality. And then we built the technology like crazy with things in it, that job aids in it, that help people to make better decisions. They never had that before, and it wasn't fair for them. You know, people weren't happy with what we were doing in VA in those days before all this. But it wasn't the employee's fault. It was the lack of good people, process, and technology capability that just didn't exist and now does.
Well, I was just reading your final love note to all the employees of the VA, and in one of your comments was that I thought was very appropriate was, you know, most of these people aren't going to file a claim willy-nilly. And so you sit down, remember, integrity, quality, grant if you can, deny only if you must.
Yeah.
And I thought that was very interesting because the reputation of the VA among veterans up until the last couple of years has been deny, deny, deny.
Until
you die, and then they'll have to worry about your claim because you don't qualify by then. And that was one of the problems that was going on, and that's the perception that you have obviously had a great deal to do with changing that perception. And now we just have to continue that on with the persons that were the people that replaced you.
Yeah, so I think we got a pretty good culture of, I'm not sure that everybody in the organization felt like they had the permission to do that. Somewhere way back when, there were, you know, processes, I think even prior to the 2000 time frames, where there was a lot of, that was the sort of model operation. And so, I said to them, no, you do what you can to say yes. And believe it or not, our employees really do want to come to work every day and, if possible, say yes. And so giving them permission to do that, I told them to put a little sticky note on their computer that had those three things on it to remind them that, you know, that's the way we approach this environment. We figure out how to say yes unless we absolutely can't. And so the grant, but by the way, I will tell you there's a little bit of some misunderstanding in that, because even prior to my arriving there, the grant rate was hovering around 65 to 70%, and that's where it still is, in the 65 to 70% range. But for those who aren't granted, I fully understand that sometimes that feels, you know, it's not even about, you know, the resources or anything else. It's just about somebody acknowledging something that you're dealing with, whether that's a visible wound of war or a physical, or, you know, or an invisible wound of war. You really, this process for some reason really helps them to feel validated in what they deal with every day.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what we hear from the veterans. They just want somebody at the VA to hear the whole story and give a reasoned approach, which they can accept or not, but they want to feel like they were heard.
Yeah.
In our final 5 minutes, I'd like to cover three topics. I know that in the 4.5 years you were the Undersecretary of Benefits at the VA, you were in the hot seat. And I want you to talk to us a little bit about that hot seat. I also want to hear your view on certified case managers, and finally talking a little bit more about successful transformation and change. But let's start with the hot seat.
So I fully expected to arrive, you know, and sit directly in the hot seat and stay there for all 4.5 years. But I would say when you're leading that kind of a change and the process has been so broken that, you know, people had some, you know, some concerns that it should, you know, that you got to do something fast. Well, for change, by the way, this magnitude of change, I don't know anybody in federal government or even the civilian work industry that has made such huge change with such major positive outcomes. I've just never run across it. You just don't bring on 6 enterprise IT systems that are all customer facing, that all enable you to do better across all 8 areas that you have responsibility for that meet the needs of a veteran or family member or survivor in a 3.5 year period of time. It's just unheard of. But still, you know, people are in pain and they're, you know, there's these feelings that you got to go faster, faster, faster. Well, sometimes faster, too fast can be also the undoing of do it well. And so,
and you can spend too much time talking to the critics,
yes,
or those who are taking resources away from what needs to be done. You don't have to say anything nasty about Congress, but I do wonder sometimes whether or not all those committee meetings actually move the ball forward or just take resources from the top away from what they should be doing.
So I would say that they have an oversight responsibility, but I do think sometimes it would have been better to let us do that great change without taking quite so much fire from the tree line. Because it did, you know, we were ending up writing, you know, lots of responses that we could have instead have been moving another new initiative forward. And I think that there's a balancing that has to be done around the oversight and the work that people are trying to do to make things better. And so I would encourage good collaboration in those environments to watch the balance there. And I know I'm sounding very political right now, but I am.
that's okay. That's the world in which you live.
Yes.
I don't, and so I get to be a little more blunt. Let me move you to the concept of certified case managers. You and I had some exchange on this, and I think it's really important to get your views out.
Yeah. So one of the things I have, you know, seen a growing requirement of in industry since I've been out, and even while I was in, it's this idea that patients, and I'll use the word patients, though it will convert, you'll see in a second, over to veterans, that, you know, human beings, you know, have more than just their medical care requirements in life. You know, they have the complete physical, socioeconomic window of a view of their life. You're not going to get a patient or a veteran to pay attention to their diabetes plan when they don't have a job, their family doesn't have food on the table, they're worried about staying in their home, and all the rest of those non-medical side of things. So interestingly enough, we have in certain places in VA case managers around some of our most wounded, ill, and injured where they are coordinating the efforts of sort of the physical medical response, the non-medical benefits response, and even the end-of-life palliative care and memorial affairs response. And I think, you know, growing that capacity, growing that capability so a veteran has a case manager to work with of some kind will take a lot of the confusion, the navigation issues, the who do I talk to, how do I talk to someone that knows and understands the integration of all these things, because this is my life. I'm not a medical person, and then I'm a benefits person, and then I'm a memorial affairs survivor. You know, I am all these things are part of my life, and I need somebody to help me navigate that in a broader way. Industry's moving this way towards certified case managers who not only have the responsibility to make sure all the cross-medical communities or issues are addressed, but they're also now calling on and looking for benefits for homelessness or for, you know, employment services or transportation needs or all those kind of things that we do by our DNA in VA. They actually look at us and go, man, you guys have actually got a good model for this. Why aren't we doing more of this in industry? And there's a growing discussion around that.
Well, I think it's a great idea, and it would also help VA on the whole customer service front, where I had somebody I could call and feel like they know me and they care about me and they'll navigate me through the system. So, you know, I think it's a great concept. I hope folks in Washington, D.C. are listening to you on this, and we see it blossom a little bit. We've talked about your passion on change and transformation. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing in your new consulting business, and maybe that'll wrap up with this issue of transformation and change.
Yeah, I think it's, I think a lot of people don't really know how to go through change, and they've tried changing something before and have, and for some reason it's just not, it's not worked. And often what I find and I talk to people is it becomes an all technology solution. The silver bullet is technology. Well, then I'll say, okay, but how have you also looked at how you're organized and trained to do the work? Have you examined your processes? Are you building technology that enables good processes in a good organizational model, or are you doing this as, hey, let's just build this system in a waterfall technology way, throw it to you, you figure out what to do with it, instead of the way we brought on our technology systems, which are all, you know, state-of-the-art, agile development, you know, DevOps, where we're sitting side by side with developers and people who are going to use it and fundamentally building it on, you know, back and forth like that. And I think a lot of folks just, you know, they get scared of that, so they won't make that change. And I think having led now two large changes where we did things like that, I have some seasoned scars and wounds and successes to share with others, and so I'm trying to help others who go through similar kinds of things.
Allison, as we get to the end here, why don't you wrap up and tell folks how they can follow what you're doing or keep in touch with you if you would like.
So I'm on LinkedIn. You're welcome to find me on LinkedIn, and I'll be happy to chat with you. But I do have one thing in closing if I can share with you, which is for all your women veterans out there or even your male veterans or your non-veterans who know of women who have served, please, please, please have them go register at the Women in Military Service Memorial. They can do it online. That's one of my new other advocacy perspectives, is to get more women to come forward and other family members to bring women forward who haven't yet registered. So would also leave you with that thought and that passion as well.
Well, that's great. Listeners, you've been listening to Allison Hickey, retired Brigadier General from the United States Air Force, most recently Undersecretary for Benefits for the Department of Veterans Affairs. If you have not listened to her Military Careers podcast or interview, go listen to that on veteransradio.net. Thank you for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. Dale Throneberry has been in the control room with me. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to podcasts and internet radio shows at veteransradio.net. And until next time,
you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans' Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.